Morning, everyone. The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 611. We're going to walk through the... We are in a work session. Let me say we are in a work session on 611. And we're going to walk through the most recent amendment, the dash twos. Kyle, I think that what would be most productive is if you just let the committee go through sort of section by section and highlight any changes with our legislative counsel, Alan Dale, who's been putting in yeoman's duty Sundays and nights. We'll go through the amendment, and then we have a new revenue estimate that we can go through after that, and then we'll bring some of the stakeholders up if they have any concerns, and just hear from as many people as possible. So, Kyle.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So, yeah, I'm going to work off of, we have a preliminary S up there for the dash twos. Up in OLIS. So scrolling down, the effect of the committee amendment. So most of this we have seen before. This was what Paul and I had discussed in the previous committee meetings, with a few changes that have come through through the drafting process. And, I do have Alan Dale from LCS here as well, just in case I get caught in a couple of spots where we're looking for things in the draft. But the idea, to kind of start off, we have different, really, the way we view this is different tiers that are being applied here for possible exemptions. So we have Tier 1, Tier 2, and then Tier 3 is related to the data center. So most of that is in Senate Bill 571 as amended. That language, but it's been all, it's, and as we've worked through this, it's all included right now in the 611-2s. So just to kind of, I guess we can just walk through it in the way it's drafted. start off with what we've been viewing as the Tier 1. And so what that is, we've really, the way it's been set up right now is, without going into the whole history again of central assessment, but we have the unitary assessment, which takes in intangible and tangible value, and then gets that gets allocated to Oregon. And
let's see which one is in the draft.
Oh, yeah, that's probably. Thank you, Alan. So Tier 1, I'm starting off here with Section
Chair.
2.
Mr. Chair, could we time out and figure out what document you're on? I mean, I'm sifting through all my materials, and I don't want to get way behind on this. So where did you find that document on OLIS?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Edwards, the dash two, if on OLIS, if you click under specifically for the SB 611, the work session, the dash two amendment is up there under the amendments drop down tab, I guess. I have it up on the screen here.
And then the preliminary SMS that's up there is the dash two.
Yes, the preliminary SMS is related to the dash two. And then if you want to see the actual amendment.
Yeah, no, I saw the actual amendment. So you're going off of the preliminary SMS document?
Yeah, the right down here at the bottom, Senator Edwards, yes.
Okay, thank you. Got it.
Yeah, so in the preliminary SMS, it's under the effective committee amendment.
I got it.
Just had a dash two there. Okay. So the tier one is, the bulk of that is going to be in section two and section three of the bill. And so sticking with the tier one, the first set is we have there's an existing exemption for intangibles right now, and that's related to FCC licenses. So that's the one existing exemption that's under current law now. And there'd be two additional ones that are being added here. One is related to the franchise exemption, or franchise, the value of franchise, excuse me, and then also the value of satellites would be in there as well, and these are specific to communication companies. And the way it's written is you would only a company would only be able to avail themselves to one of those three, so it wouldn't be a combination. So if the FCC license gives you the most tax relief, that's the one you'd use. if franchises, that would be it, but you wouldn't combine those three together.
Hold on. It's in section four if you want to tell them.
Oh, yeah, thanks. And that, I'm sorry, that portion is in section four. And I guess it's easier maybe if I'll try to hit the high points of what's in there, and then we can kind of get more into the specifics of where they are in the bill. But if I think we start with a broad overview, can then go through and say that's the tier one that's related to the exemption there, if that works. And maybe I'll try to put Alan on the spot for that. But so we have those two additional exemptions, and those would apply under the kind of the current law standard way of assessment, so the unitary style assessment. And then we have what we've been talking about also is this other cap calculation. This is the one right now. It would be historic cost for the company times multiplied by 1.3, and then you would take the lesser of your current law unitary assessment with those two exemptions in there. So you'd calculate it whether you have FCC or if you're going to take the franchise exemption or for satellites. And that would be, you do that calculation first, and then you look at this historic cost times 1.3 calculation and see if there's any benefit there. And if there is benefit under the alternative historic cost times 1.3 calculation, that would be the one you'd use to calculate your tax. Now, if that 1.3 times historic cost would come out with a higher value, that would not be used. So there's no chance this secondary calculation would actually increase taxes. If for some reason it does calculate out to something higher, which will happen for the vast majority of companies won't see relief on this, they would just stick with their current unitary valuation. So there would be no backdoor increase here. I guess I'll. Now, is there something you'd like to add to those sections?
No.
No. Okay. And I guess something I should have noted when I'm talking about these exemptions amount, it is related to the booked value. So your booked value, your FCC licenses, the booked value, your franchise exemption, or satellites. So what that means is that would generally be the value that's reported on, like the 10-Ks reported to the SEC. So these are from publicly available documents that would allow, most of this stuff will be submitted to the Department of Revenue in part of the valuation process, but there would also be a secondary check that they could do if needed to go out and look at what's being publicly filed.
Kyle, you're in section four here. Could you explain the either or, the or but not both language and the policy reason?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I believe the idea behind that, and this is in other areas as well, is to avoid kind of a double dipping in some ways. So that's originally, that was the same thing with the historic cost times 1.3, was to make sure you wouldn't do that calculation and then apply FCC licenses and maybe an exemption for your franchises and for satellites to continue to lower and lower. So that's I think the policy decision on the 1.3. For the three unitary exemptions at the unitary level for value, I believe it follows the kind of the same approach. It's just you choose one or the other, because each one is addressing, or at least for FCC licenses and franchises, it's addressing the intangible value that the company has and providing some level of relief for that.
Okay.
So I think that was the idea by only allowing one and not a combination of two or three. And the one thing that's unique about the satellite exemption is that is tangible value as well. So if you allowed all three of those, you could have two kind of exemptions for intangible value plus an additional one for tangible value.
So that's what I wanted to ask you about on the satellites, why the distinction there, perhaps.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I can talk a little bit about this in the revenue impact as well, but okay. From what the documentation we've seen and what I've been able to obtain that's publicly available online from the SEC filings and everything, there is companies that have satellites in a lot of cases will also have FCC licenses, and there may be more benefit under the FCC license. So in that case, they would continue taking that exemption rather than for this tangible value, which is the satellites. And I think that originally the kind of the idea behind the bill was to provide some relief on the tangible value, because that's really the difference between local assessment and central assessment, is it grabs in that intangible value.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I could add something here that fits in with section four. If you look in section four, sub four, there is a reference to how the franchises are calculated, and this is an issue that we had talked about and worked around. And what the amendment does here, if you look on line 29, it takes those franchises for a company and subtracts that value from the assessed value of the property. And in the earlier renditions of this, it was off the market value. So this does have the effect of taking it from a lower level or assessed value and then applying that franchise exemption to that level.
Appreciate that change.
Yes. And we can also discuss the revenue implications of that later on.
When we get done.
So I think that covers most of the tier one. So we'd be moving on to, in the bill, it begins on page three, but section five, which is the tier two. It's also been referred to, I think, as the big enchilada, it's the super highway. Okay, so the tier two is really about more of a prospective investment. So there's a project, we have some minimum requirements that a project would have to meet to qualify for this exemption. And some of that is, we discussed this a little bit with the PUC here the other day, would have some oversight role, not regulatory, but just more receiving the forms and double checking and making sure everything is lining up with what's in statute. But the I'm on page four, section five, subsection 2B talks about the investment or the type of communication service. So we're talking 1 gigabit per second symmetrical, and we've had Vince Porter's been here to kind of talk about how that's different. We originally had gigabyte, so we have made that change, so we're not. We are talking about gigabit per second symmetrical. That's both upload and download speed. There's some limitations on cost to customers to make sure that it's within 150% of the United States average price, and also some service level requirements as well. So the territory would be determined by the company, but they would have to provide service up to 50% is kind of a tiered approach. So at first, the initial rollout could be to, like, I believe it starts at 30% of the customers within the territory. And this is in section six that talks about that. So the initial rollout would start a little bit lower, eventually getting up to the 50%. But so the calculation in this case, see if I can find the I should add that an application fee was also is in the dash 2 minutes of $50,000, and that's to help cover we talked a little bit about this, but we to help cover some of the costs that would be, or hopefully all the costs associated for the Department of Revenue and the PUC. We have the request out to fiscal, so we'll be getting that paperwork hopefully today with those final numbers, but we have had some reach out to Department of Revenue and PUC as well.
Okay.
But so the idea behind the tier two calculation is the number that's in there right now. It was a blank a couple drafts ago, but it's now at $250 million or the tangible, the real market value of the tangible property in Oregon. And the idea behind this, it would work similar to the way the SIP program has worked in some ways, the Strategic Investment Program, and it'd really be a floor. And a company that makes an investment, and this is going to be it's going to be a large investment, certainly, the floor would be the greater of their real market or tangible value here in Oregon or that $250 million. So the investment is most likely going to be close to that $250 million or more before you'd really get the full benefit of the exemption. And that would be the amount that you would be taxed, the company would be taxed on. And then the difference there, between their full value with the intangible value and then the tangible property that's here in Oregon or that $250 million is the exemption amount. And that's generally going to line up with the intangible value. So the idea is it would be more akin to what the value would be if they were locally assessed rather than centrally assessed. But that's the tier two. It would require a rather large investment, and that's where for a company that does have a high level of intangibles that is looking to possibly maybe locate and providing a service here in Oregon, there's the tier two approach. But there's also in tier one that historic cost times 1.3 that could also offer relief for a company from their intangible tax or valuation. So if you're thinking for maybe a prospective company, if they're not thinking of doing a really large investment, but maybe roll out in some of the maybe like a rural area or something along those lines, the historic cost times 1.3 would provide some sort of relief for them related to their intangible valuation. Okay. And then the last section, the tier three, really it's the data centers. Let me get there. Bear with me for 1 second. So the data center language begins on. Oh, I have an old one. Sorry, the draft. Just make sure I have my page numbers in order here. It begins on page 9 with section 8 of the dash 2. And as I said earlier, this does line up in many ways with the language in 571-1. There have been some changes there as we haven't been, I guess, really updating 571 to keep in line with the 611 amendments, but the idea is kind of the same. So the major, the issue that we were facing with data centers was that a company could invest in data center property, which would have them cause them to be centrally assessed due to becoming a communication company. And by doing that, that would bring in all of their intangible valuation into the valuation process, not just the value of the data center. And so the worry was that for a company that has a data center that has a really high degree of intangibles to tangible value, that could be quite a tax bill just on when you base it on what the value of, say, their data center is. So if their data center's $200 million, they could have a tax bill maybe several million dollars higher than what it would be if you just locally assessed it. And that could obviously cause some issues for companies that are already here or prospective companies as well. So the language here is to take, if a company has data center property and the value of all other property that would be subject to central assessment, so that'd be only communication property or other utility type property, so that wouldn't include and let me actually get to the language here on page 10, beginning on lines 11, there's kind of a listing, but it wouldn't include any of the property not subject to central assessment, which would include such thing as office, warehouse, retail outlets, those type of things. And we have a cap of 10% of the value of the data center. So what you would do is you'd say, okay, we have the data center value, and you find 10% of that. And a company could have up to 10% of that data center value property related to what would normally be centrally assessed, maybe communication, and still not be pulled into the central assessment. So it allows a little bit of existential property, I guess, related to communication services that isn't necessarily part of the data center. The company can have a little bit of that, but if they go over that 10% threshold, they would then be subject to central assessment. So,
can I say something?
Yeah.
Sorry. For the record, Alan Dale, Deputy Legislative Counsel, Senator Hass, members of the committee. For the purpose of the 10% cap, the property counted is tangible property other than data centers owned or leased by the company in Oregon, is in service and used by the company in the business of communication. So it wouldn't be all property used in some centrally assessable business. It would be just used in the business of communication. And we added is in service to distinguish between whatever data centers are made of that are actually plugged in and operating and unplugged property that is stored in a warehouse. So the unplugged property wouldn't count towards the 10%, just the operating property. And then the in B, what is it, 3B, that list is just clarification that companies wanted to just have it in the statute that this kind of property is not considered to be used by the company in the business of communication.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Alan. Yeah, it's really in addition to that language in some cases, just to make no mistake, clarification.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So things that would be counted are things like fiber in the ground. Is that?
Chair Hess, Senator Riley, if it's being used for a communication purpose, it would depend. Because if it's part of the data center itself, then it wouldn't be subject to, because it's considered part of the data center, so it's in that value of property. But yeah, if a company owns a data center and they also are operating a fiber network or something like that, certainly that could pull them in depending upon the value of it.
So that fiber in the ground would count if it's used for communication. That's part of that to get us above 10%.
Yes, Senator Riley, and part of that for the 10% also, it was kind of a protection a bit to stop to avoid a company that is subject to central assessment of simply building a data center or acquiring a data center of maybe even just extremely modest value or something along those lines and pulling out all of their other currently assessed property from central assessment. So it provides a protection there as well. Let's see. So in section 9, related to data center, we do have language defining data centers that was already in statute, I think, for the most part. Now, if there was some changes, I think it's for the most part using what was already existing under 308.516. The language is in bold in the 611-2, but I just wanted to call attention. That's just because it's using existing language and kind of moving where it is.
Okay.
Yeah, so I think that hits most of the high points.
Let me talk about section 2.
Yeah, Alan. Yeah.
Okay. Again, for the record, Alan Dale, Deputy Legislative Counsel, Sender House, members of the committee. Section 2, the purpose there is that Tier 1 and Tier 2 are intended to be mutually exclusive, and so instead of having the companies elect whichever one would be most favorable to them, which they might, you know, it's better for the state to do it. So we have the draft directs the Department of Revenue, in the case of a company that's eligible for both, to determine which one would be more favorable. And it isn't just which one of the two caps would be more favorable, but if in each of them, they determine the sort of current, they determine the value under current central assessment law and then under the cap. Well, if the cap isn't more favorable, then they would just do current central assessment. So this involves three possibilities, and the Department of Revenue will assess the property in the way that is provides the least value for the company. I didn't say that quite right, but I think you know what I mean.
The lower amount.
Yeah.
The lower tax.
Well, there's more than two. That's the thing. More than two possibilities. So it is the least amount of value will be put on the roll.
Okay. Just to clarify one thing that is important, I want to get on the record. The section that says to data centers that you will never be subject to central assessment can best be found on page 10, that section of the dash 2, and page 9, section 8, I think is what we're talking about. The heart, can you give us the heart of that statement?
Yeah, I can take a shot at it,
sure.
Senator Hess. So yeah, and it begins on section 8 on page 9. Section 8, just going down to lines 21 through 23, I think is really the beginning of that. A company that is in the business of communication as defined in ORS 308-505, that's the central assessment statute, and is the owner or lessee of a data center, is not a company described in ORS 308-515-1, which is the listing of all the centrally assessed properties. So it says communication, rail, so on and so forth. So that's the one that really pulls it out right there. And then the language afterwards is really, as Alan was saying, it talks more about kind of that 10% cap, what is included, what is not, and really trying to clarify for the 10% cap, try to make that as clear as possible, because I think we've had some confusion there of our retail outlets going to be part of that. And it's like, no, okay, let's not only does it say it in the statute, but then it's almost the on page 10, there's kind of a list. Emphasis, if you will. Yeah.
I agree. That's a good word, emphasis. So the goal here is to make it as clear as possible that these data centers never get pulled into central assessment.
Senator Haas, members of the committee, are you referring to a previous provision where the property of data centers would have been locally assessed?
No. I just want us to go to the heart of that section that makes it abundantly clear.
I don't think the data centers would never be centrally assessed. I think if the property other than data centers of the company used in the business of communication equals 10% or less of the data center property, then the data centers of that company will not be centrally assessed.
That's what I meant. Thanks for clarifying.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Haas, if I can just add to that, it's a data center in and of itself is not going to pull a company into central assessment. So it's going to take other property that would do that to bring them in. So if you build a data center, that alone, more or less, is not going to bring that company into central assessment. Now, if you are a communication company that also has data centers, that'll be part of it. But that's the protection really there is.
Because really that's the heart of it. That's what is driving the speed for this, is this clarification. And that there was this cloud raised by the Supreme Court ruling, and I just wanted to be able to the committee to point to if you.
Senator Haas, so I think your point is if the company, the only property that the company used in Oregon in the business of communication or in a centrally assessable business was data centers, then they would not be a centrally assessed company.
It's pretty clear.
Yes.
Okay. We have a revenue impact statement based on this. When I look at it, Kyle, I'll let you go through it. And it is circumspect for our purposes here. And it says there would be about a $15 million loss in property taxes throughout the state under this amendment. I'm wondering if you could also, with your other charts available to you, talk about what the increase would be from the 2009 property tax year when the litigation started.
Yes, Mr. Chair, absolutely. So under, I'm in OLS again, under the meeting materials, and I've already clicked on the SB 611, the preliminary revenue impact is under meeting materials just because it was preliminary. I didn't want it to be in kind of the official revenue impact. We'll have that language hopefully tightened up, or the paperwork ready to go a little bit later. So if I get that open, yeah, as you just described, we do have the box there that I think the committee members probably used to seeing a revenue impact statement. And I can start, let me start with the chart you just alluded to, because we've kind of seen that. So I just put that on the second page.
Okay.
Of the revenue impact statement. So this is, just to go through briefly once again, we've seen this a few times for kind of each of the different iterations we've had for the SB 611. And it goes back, it starts with fiscal year 2008-09, which was kind of before some of the new, or some of the how do I describe it? I guess it's before the Comcast decision, really, the years that were in discussion there. So you kind of have a base before the definition of communication, it didn't really, it's not really being changed at all. Maybe I'll just move on. Maybe it's just easier. But so for fiscal year in 2008-09, we saw that the current imposed was about $176.1 million. So this first column here is the centrally assessed imposed excluding deferred billing credits. So for the most part, that's going to be excluding some of this broadened interpretation, if you will, that has been upheld at least through stage one of the Supreme Court. So the definition of communication has been settled by the Supreme Court. There is still some question to the MAV in question, and that's why that's been remanded to the tax court. But so we have the deferred billing credits are kind of that increment additional value that that could potentially come in depending upon what the final resolution of the court case is. So the reason the deferred billing credits exist, just once again, was by putting them kind of off to the side and tracking them on the side of the roll, more or less, the dollars aren't collected, so the company in question hasn't had to pay, or the companies in question haven't had to pay these. So the dollars haven't been received, but then when they do, or if they get received, they would come in without any penalties, fees, interest, or in the opposite, if the companies were to prevail, then there would be no refund of taxes because they haven't been collected, and the refunds would be including, under normal law, would be including interest, which could be quite a sizable hit for some of the districts. So that was what the deferred billing credit language came, the deferred billing credit law kind of came out of that idea where all this could come out at one time, which could be quite a hit for local districts, and especially when you add on the interest. So under total current law imposed, if we're kind of skipping ahead to up to 1415, which is based on an estimate, we don't have the deferred billing credit data in yet for the 1415, but just kind of trending it forward, we'd be at about $278.8 million under current law. Without the deferred billing credits, we're at $250.1 million. And under the Dash 2 amendments, as we've worked through it, we'd be at about $263.1 million for that if we applied it to the 1415 year, which the law wouldn't take effect, but just for a frame of reference. That would be what would be imposed.
Thank you. So while technically the revenue impact sheet will say a $15 million loss in property taxes from current law, there's widespread belief that the current law is almost unworkable and is in an endless swamp of litigation. Under this proposal with the Dash 2s, is it fair to say that it would result in $86 million more in property tax revenues than the 2008-2009 tax year when the litigation started?
Mr. Chair, so in some of the growth, the 160, kind of the 176 and going forward would just be the standard, I guess, growth unrelated to any of these changes, just kind of like a trend forward on the value of utility properties. So I'm not sure it'd be quite the full difference there.
13 million.
But certainly it'd be from the 250, using the 250.1 to the 263, that $13 million there, it would be that amount that could be in question, really, if the court case is decided, depending on where it is, really a question of kind of maximum assessed value. So depending on where that could possibly get set, if it's set right where it is under local assessment, it would kind of wipe all the deferred billing credits, is probably what would happen. Then it would be that $13.1 million in that year that would take that hit. And just as a broad note on the revenue impact, for the tier two, that kind of that large investment that is a potential exemption, anything that would be prospective wouldn't be included in there as well. I should probably just note that. So if we knew of something that was absolutely in the pipeline that's going to happen because of this, we could possibly fold that in. But otherwise, creating kind of exemption language that would hopefully possibly incentivize a company to locate here, that wouldn't be in the revenue impact, but that would show up later on. And that's that distinction between current law and how we have to base our estimates. So just to kind of, I guess that's more of a, in, you know, 6 years from now, 4 years from now, in the tax expenditure report, at least by the governor's office, it would be included of that whole difference from current law, even though that doesn't exist right now today.
Okay. Questions for these guys? We'll have you stand by. We're gonna have some people come up and maybe there's rebuttals involved, I don't know. So we're in work session on 611. Before we go any further, I do want to announce, as before we get some people up, stakeholders involved in this, please do not have your lawyers call down to the Legislative Council offices directly. There is a protocol and a process to do that, and I can't tell you strongly enough that that is counterproductive. So we're going to take a few people up here, and then we'll sort of weigh what needs to be done before we move this out. So let's start with Greg Chamoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Greg Chamoff from the law firm of Davis Wright Tremaine, appearing on behalf of Yahoo. I hope that admonition was not directed at me, since that was a rule I invoked to begin with.
Thank you. It was not. You more than anyone appreciate it.
Wanted to call your attention to the page 11 of the -2 amendments, particularly lines 26 through 30, and then bleeding over onto page 12, line 1. While attempting to address Yahoo's situation, which I remind you is we have an office building in Oregon. It does office things. We don't have any communication infrastructure. What the company also does, if you happen to go online and make use of its information, is provide, among other things, a search engine. My favorite is the Fantasy Leagues, despite the fact that I keep losing to everyone in LFO. There are three problems with the way that this language is structured. One is, in line 28, refers to electronic mail accounts and search engines as data transmission service. Email accounts and search engines are not data transmission services. And if that language could be reworked, it would get much closer to addressing Yahoo's situation without opening up the definition of data transmission service. This particular exemption is also placed in ORS 308.516, which is a section in which companies are excluded from central assessment based on certain characteristics. If you don't have the characteristics to be centrally assessed to begin with, you shouldn't be in the exemption. And so from a conceptual standpoint, exempting someone from something that they're not subject to in the first place isn't the best way to achieve that, because then the argument could be you might be covered anyway because we put you in this exemption. And I think you've heard from other people representing other interests, that's a means of interpretation that folks are trying to avoid. The best solution would be to go back to the concept of the -1 amendments, where what the services are that are being provided that are not data transmission services are defined as not data transmission services. That would be a much better, cleaner way to take care of the problem. The fundamental problem with the way that the exemption is provided here, and although with some language changes it would address Yahoo's narrow situation, is that it doesn't recognize that the activities that companies are engaged in are not communication activities when they are using someone else's communication infrastructure. If you think of the example of UPS. If you send a package on UPS, that does not make you a shipping company. And the way that this exemption is written, there are a couple of kind of packages that you send on UPS that don't make you a shipping company, but conceivably there are other kind of packages you could send on UPS that would make you a shipping company, even though you don't own the trucks or have any control over them. Our pitch would be we would very much appreciate it if we could have the opportunity to work a little more on this language to get it into a situation in which it addresses Yahoo's situation without at the same time making the problem potentially larger. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you, sir.
I do have a question. Over there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you define counsel, and I know you're a lawyer, so don't take forever to do this. Could you define a little time and what wording might be? How long would it take to do a little wording to clarify that the exemption already is an exemption, so why are we restating the exemption, which is really the issue? And I get it. I understand that.
Am I working with Mr. Dale or the Department of Revenue?
Well, I'm no fan of the Department of Revenue, so.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Senator Boquist, that was a serious question.
Right.
I can go down the hall and work with Mr. Dale right now to come up with language. It probably wouldn't take more than about 15 or 20 minutes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Drew Hagedorn.
Chair House, members of the committee, Rocky Dahlem from Tonkin Torp. We represent DirecTV Dish, the satellite industry. Would like to introduce Jeremy Kudon from Orrick Harrington, who's come today to talk about how the language affects the satellite industry and answer any questions you have. Thanks.
Great, thanks. Good morning, Chairman Haas and members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Kudon, and I am here today on behalf of DirecTV and Dish Network, the two major or only satellite providers in Oregon. Together, my clients provide pay TV service to over 500,000 families in Oregon, which I believe is almost half of the families in the state. We have a vested interest in reforming central assessment. The move to central assessment, which was made by the Department of Revenue in 2009, has quadrupled my clients' property tax bills in this state. And while we've held off passing those increases onto our customers, we can only do that for so long. At some point, we will have to raise our rates in Oregon to make up for the 25% increase in our cost of doing business in this state. Now, we thought this week we'd come up with an elegant fix, or at least, when I say a fix, some type of relief to central assessment for our clients and for our subscribers. The idea was to exempt certain forms of property from taxation to mitigate the impact of the move to central assessment. And that brings us back to Section 4 of the proposed amendment. As the as LRO, I think is the term, explained earlier, there's always been an exemption from taxation under central assessment for FCC licenses. The proposed amendment, however, exempts two other types or forms of property, franchise rights and satellites. And franchise rights are the rights that you receive if you're a cable company for paying for use of the public rights of way, something that a cable company needs to do to deliver their service. They use cables. That's all. We're both pay TV services. They just deliver their service with cables under the ground. We deliver our services with satellites in space that we obtain and use through the benefit of FCC licenses that we've purchased. Unfortunately, the fix didn't exactly work out as we thought it would. The impact of the three exemptions differs wildly between the type of company that you are. So for a cable company that can now exempt franchise rights, that's a tremendous asset, and that is their largest asset, I should say, on their financial statements. So that's going to be a significant reduction for them in terms of what their tax bill will be under central assessment. For the satellite companies, if we were able to exempt the satellites and the FCC licenses, which are really an integrated system, we can't use those satellites without the FCC licenses. It's the only way we're allowed to operate. Otherwise, they'd just be useless things of junk in the sky, kind of like in the movie Gravity. Without those licenses, we can't operate. But if you just have an exemption for both of them, it would probably take our tax bills from quadruple to triple. It's relief, and it's something that my clients would be okay with. But what the current version does, or the proposed amendment does, is it requires us to choose between these three options. Now, satellite companies don't have any franchise rights. We already were allowed to exempt our FCC rights, and the satellites just don't make up that much. So right now, under the proposed amendment, our situation is actually no different than it was before. And in fact, in some cases, it's worse because our competitors are going to get this huge reduction while we get no reduction, which means that their rates can stay the same or go up just a little bit while our rates have to go up more. We're going to lose subscribers. Our subscribers get hurt. And for people who live in the rural areas in Oregon who cannot get any other type of service because cable doesn't go there, there's nothing for them to get. We have a proposed fix that we think will avoid the double dipping concern. And that fix is simply to take the term satellite and just add a few sentences that says, or a few words, that says satellites and any FCC licenses necessary to operate or use them. That way the satellite industry gets a little bit of relief, not as much as cable still, but enough that we feel there's some parity here and it doesn't hurt our consumers, and we can move on and we can deal with all the other issues with that are going on.
I appreciate your concern. Can I ask a devil's advocate question?
Of course.
Could somebody say, well, you did have this competitive advantage prior to this because those licenses were, you already had the previous exemption?
You know, that's an excellent question. The difficulty here is because central assessment was something that was imposed by the Department of Revenue, I don't think anyone ever thought that we had some kind of advantage. In fact, we've been paying them for 4 years, but we've been both us and Comcast in litigation. So I don't think we viewed that as some kind of advantage. And I don't think we felt, especially since they're so small compared to the franchise rates, it's just a different in mechanism. So the impact on us as a percentage basis is much higher, even with the current FCC exemption. So I don't think we're not here saying take away cable's rights. I think what we're saying is just let's not, using the double dipping analogy, right now we have the proposed amendment allows one company to use a digger or a bulldozer to dip while we're using a little teaspoon to dip. I tried. That was it. I flew out from New York last night, but that's the idea. It's just that little fix. I got in the gravity reference, but any other questions, though?
No, I appreciate you coming out here. Welcome to Oregon. I wish you could go see Multnomah Falls or something instead of coming down here. But, we got a tall order here, and we're trying to settle this intangibles issue and cut data centers loose. But if the chore is to go beyond that and create a competitive and fair playing field for an industry that is blowing apart day by day with new technology, I don't think we can do that. So we're trying our best to be fair. So thank you for your comments, Senator Boquist.
I have two questions, if you would, Mr. Chair. Just to make sure I understand, since I don't know you from Adam, but I used to be in the business of, looking at satellites and see which ones are going to come down. So therefore, I get the connection between FCC because I didn't care. We're going to take them out anyway, and satellites. But what you're really saying here is that, if the FCC license is for the satellite, then they ought to be combined. That's
correct.
That's my first question. So that's a simple one. And the second question, you saw there was another lawyer, but I'm guessing you are a lawyer, right?
I am.
Okay. My condolences.
That's okay.
is that. You mean you said fix? I mean, what are you talking about in terms of fix? Like a three-word change, something that takes 15 minutes to propose.
I think it's a six. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. About 10 words at the end of.
And you have the 10 words in your possession. Okay, that's.
I think
that
we have
my question.
I think Rocky has them right here.
Okay, that was my question. Thank you.
And that fix, by the way, would avoid double dipping because I understand we wanted to have and for all three exceptions, but we understand that some companies could take a huge deduction by doing that. This way we would keep it so that you don't have the double dipping.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Okay, there were some people that asked to weigh in here and others didn't, and so I'm assuming that if you didn't ask, is the Department of Revenue here? We do have a letter correspondence from them basically giving the green light to this amendment. So we'll work off that understanding for now. And we had intended to pass this out this morning, and so what we'll do is, I know there was a couple of little issues that won't change the bill dramatically. We're going to meet with Legislative Council and Dr. Warner, work group, and some committees to see whether changes can be made, whether they should be made, and then we'll reconnoiter back here at 3 o'clock with the purpose of voting this bill out. And if we don't vote it out today, we're not going to do any more on central assessment this session. So, is that okay? So we will recess 6:11 for now, and we will return on that issue at 3 o'clock, and we then will move to a work session on 64. I'd like to open up a work session on Senate Bill 64. This is the Metro Bill, Mazin. Mazin, did you want to give a reminder or update?
Yes, sure, Mr. Chair. I'll talk slowly until everybody gets a chance to leave.
Yeah, sorry, that keeps happening to you, doesn't it?
Please, don't take it personally. We're worried about your self-esteem.
No, I'm actually glad that I could do that. It's easier to get to an agreement, I guess. So just to refresh your memory about this Senate Bill 64, you had the Convention Center Hotel issue, and this was a discussion that came to you from Metro, and they were proposing a change in the language of the statutes in order to allow them to be able to issue bonds in order to build or allow for building and seeding the project. And moving the ability to do that from what it is now in the statutes, which allows that to be preceding the time when they had the charter, to the time that actually after that they've established that, and therefore takes out the threat of litigation that is going on. And you had heard from the different sides of this issue on that first meeting that you had. And as we looked at it, you also have an AULIS. In addition to those documents, you have letters coming. And as we looked at it, we see this as an enabling legislation, and thus does not necessarily have a revenue impact, and the fiscal office also determined that it does not have a fiscal impact.
Does not have a fiscal impact yet, so we cannot move it yet.
No, it does not have.
It does not have
an expenditure impact.
So we have the paperwork.
Yes, we do.
Okay. okay, committee, we do have some people from Metro here in case you have any questions. I know that it's inevitable that our argument on this bill is an argument over whether the Convention Center Hotel should be built or not and how. But to me, this bill doesn't get into that issue. It simply clarifies some existing law and legislative intent. So I'm ready to go unless somebody has some questions of Metro or Mazin, Senator Boquist.
I'm a no vote, but I'm happy to move it and vote no.
Okay.
I'm one of those odd people.
Okay. So, Senator Edwards, why don't you, if you will, make a motion?
You can do it by heart.
We don't have any. No amendments?
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 64 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Edwards moves Senate Bill 64 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Boquist?
Well, I see down there.
Yeah, I also have some, but go ahead.
I'm just for the record, a no vote. And it really has to do with moving the language around in the lawsuit, and you and I discussed this.
Okay. Senator Riley.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to say I view this as a jobs bill. This is a bill that's going to create some really good jobs, and I think it's really important to get this get this done and working.
Thank you. Yes, thank you. Okay.
I would like to declare a potential conflict of interest. So
your interest.
Out of a really, really overabundance of caution, I have discussed and worked on a business plan that is in the tourism industry, which could largely be affected in Oregon by this bill. So I just wanted to
Okay.
I might stay at the hotel.
Make sure that I'm super super clear.
So no.
And Mr. Chairman, I have no idea where Senator Birchsiger is, so.
Yes, Senator Birchsiger is excused on legislative business. So let's do a roll call.
Senator Edwards.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Boklas.
No.
Senator Haas.
Haas votes yes. The measure passes. Senate Bill 64 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Senator Riley, would you care to carry this bill?
I will. Thank you.
Okay. All right, so we're in recess until 3 o'clock. We will see you then. In recess until 3 o'clock. We will see you then.